Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Government Coercion of Separated Parents call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call is being recorded. I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Ben Johnson, Executive Director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for joining the call. As you know, this morning, the American Immigration Council and the American Immigration Lawyers Association filed a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties and with the Inspector General at the Department of Homeland Security. This complaint and the stories that you'll see in it, that are contained in it, really, they document the ongoing abuses that are occurring as a result of the Trump administration's policy of family separation and zero tolerance. And quite frankly, they highlight the fact that those labels, you know, family separation and zero tolerance, really are an inadequate description of what's happening and what has happened and what continues to happen. You know, I think it's very important to look beneath those labels and remind ourselves of what's happening here. And this really is a systematic and intentional effort to take children away from their parents and hold them as hostages in order to sabotage their right to apply for asylum in the United States, and then to use these children as a threat to other parents who are attempting to or maybe contemplating coming to the United States to apply for asylum. Both this family separation and zero tolerance labels describe that really ugly reality of coercion and intimidation. There are two important lessons, I think, to learn from these stories and from what's happening. And the first is that this tragedy of family separation and zero tolerance as tools of coercion and intimidation is not over. It's an ongoing saga. And I think it's important to understand that this is not just about the moment of separation, but all of the other intimidation and coercion surrounding that intentional moment of taking children away from parents. And the second really important lesson for all of us to understand is that this kind of abuse is only possible in our immigration system because it just does not have the adequate protections to guard against this kind of conduct and abuse. The recent last couple of months have reminded us that the immigration courts, for instance, operate under the control of the Attorney General. They are not an independent check and balance on the system. They do not have the opportunity to act as a safety net against efforts to prioritize speed over accuracy or fairness. There are very limited due process protections in the system beyond that. There isn't much of an exclusionary rule to prevent this evidence or these declarations of these waivers of rights, the opportunity to examine them and determine whether they were coerced in immigration court is all very limited. The system simply does not have those kinds of protections built into it. All of that is amplified by the fact that 85-90% of the immigrants who are in detention do not have access to an attorney. They are navigating this incredibly complicated, incredibly dangerous system on their own. And then the other piece I think that's worth reminding ourselves is that there are, in many instances, very limited federal court review over what's happening in immigration court. So all of those systemic problems mean that this kind of abuse is more likely to happen in our immigration system than any place else, and that we must be purposeful in ensuring that this kind of violations don't happen and that we build and not only do we stop this crisis now, but we build an immigration system that is better at protecting against it for the future. So let's dig into the details of these particular cases and this complaint. We have with us today Katie Shepard, who's the National Advocacy Council at the American Immigration Council, was actively involved in putting these cases together. Shefu Hardy, who's the managing attorney at the Dilley Pro Bono Project, who on a day-to-day basis oversees the representation and the providing of counsel and advice to the victims of these policies at the South Texas Family Detention Center in Dilley, Texas. And Taylor Levy, who is the legal coordinator at Annunciation House in El Paso, Texas, who was really at ground zero in the family separation saga and dealing with the families that were being separated and trying to be part of, you know, being really was an on-the-ground witness to how this all unfolded for those families and their cases. So Shay, Katie, let's start with you. Can you give us a little more detail, a little more background on this complaint?
Thanks so much, Ben. So as Ben stated, this morning the American Immigration Council and the American Immigration Lawyers Association filed a joint complaint with the two oversight agencies of the Department of Homeland Security, the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, and the Office of the Inspector General, regarding the use of extreme coercive tactics at the hands of ICE and CBP officials against this very vulnerable population of separated parents in DHS custody. Not only did the U.S. government create a policy which led to thousands of immigrant children being torn from their parents' arms and sent to undisclosed locations around the country, but the parents were then coerced into signing documents they may not have understood, ostensibly waiving their legal rights, including their right to be reunified with their children. Dozens of separated parents, most of whom signed paperwork presented to them by ICE and CBP officers, remain detained and separated from their children, and hundreds of parents have been deported back to possible harm without their children. In the complaint, we lift up the stories of 13 parents, some of whom remain separated from their children. The 13 stories illustrate a much larger systemic problem. Through our work in El Paso and also in Dilley, Texas, we personally spoke with dozens of separated parents who described the various degrees of coercion they endured in addition to verbal and physical abuse and mistreatment. We encourage you to read the complaint, which contains original testimony from the parents themselves. We found that the coercion and the coercive environment created by government officials really started at the moment that these families entered U.S. soil. Many parents report that while they were held in CBP short-term detention facilities, state that they were given inadequate and spoiled food, being forced to sleep on cold concrete floors and next to toilets, or being unable to sleep as a result of the cramped conditions, forcing people to stand. These conditions, combined with the trauma of family separation, created an inordinately coercive and stressful environment which colored every interaction that they had with any government officials thereafter. The parents also report a pattern of more explicit coercion at the hands of DHS officers. One mother described how an ICE officer, nicknamed the Deporter, physically intimidated her while trying to get her to sign a voluntary departure form, standing over her menacingly and shouting at her to sign. This woman was subsequently placed in solitary confinement and subject to starvation for days after she shouted to draw the attention of a visiting official. The trauma of being separated from their children, as well as the coercive environment created by CBP and ICE officers, made it very difficult for parents to participate meaningfully during the credible fear interview process and their proceedings, if any, before the immigration judge. We also surveyed 76 mothers who had been separated from their children and asked by ICE officers to sign a form affecting their rights to be reunified with their kids. Over 90% of the mothers reported that they were not allowed to ask about the consequences of signing the form. As a result, less than 25% of these mothers expressed that they understood what they were signing. Disturbingly, 67% of mothers reported that ICE intimidated or coerced them prior to having them sign a form affecting their rights to reunification. Worse, 30% reported that ICE officers threatened that if the mother did not sign the form, they would never see their children again. Finally, we urge the oversight divisions of DHS to investigate this alarming trend and these illegal actions by government officials. Now I'm going to hand it back over to Ben, who will introduce you to our other speakers.
Thanks, Katie. Again, Shay Fluharty is managing attorney at the Dilley Pro Bono Project. Shay, why don't you give us your perspective on how this happened and what this complaint is about.
Every night around 7 p.m., a group of mothers and children ranging from 5 to 17 years old gather in Dilley, Texas, in a facility illuminated by floodlights behind fences and locked doors. The teenagers often sit in a circle next to their mothers holding their hands. The younger children cling to them, bouncing on their knees, sleeping in their arms. Most recently, some of the 8 to 12-year-olds have started to run around the circle, begging me for crayons, for coloring. Crayons are contraband in the jail, so I have to direct them to uniformed employees who, depending on the person and the hour, may or may not offer up the crayons that sit in the drawer in the desk. In this circle, most nights, the mothers cry. They weep. They tell stories of being separated from their children. They say they were treated like dogs. They were thrown in cages. They sit in silence when each story gets to the worst part, the part when they were taken away from their children. One woman states she was told her daughter would be right back moments later. Then her daughter vanished. No one told her where her daughter was, who her daughter was with, if her daughter was safe, if she would ever see her again. She begged officials to tell her how to find her daughter, how to call her. She was told if she kept crying, she would be put in isolation, she would be denied food, she would be deported. Another mother remembers being detained a few cells away from another father who was also separated from her his child. One day, all of the mothers in her cell were taken from their rooms. They were told the father had hung himself because he was so distraught over the separation. When these stories begin every night in the circle, they continue without end. Another mother was told her daughter had been placed up for adoption. Many mothers nod their heads. They too were told this information. When they finally found their children, after being subjected to interviews with an asylum officer or a hearing before an immigration judge, which resulted in their deportation, they heard stories from their children. One mother learned her son had an emergency operation during their separation. Another learned her daughter was hit while she was detained by the government far away from her safety. Her daughter was told she would never see her mother again. Another child was ridiculed because he speaks a rare indigenous language. He was bullied into speaking Spanish. He no longer wants to speak his first language with his mother. Sometimes these mothers sit in silence. Many times they ask me questions. They ask why they were separated from their children. They ask why they were told that they would be reunited and released, and then they were taken to another jail in the middle of nowhere. They question how the government can detain their children for so long, for so many months, now more than 4 months for many of the children. How long are their children supposed to live in jail? They want to know why they have been treated so differently from everyone else. Why were they separated and detained? Why were they reunited and detained again? Why have they not been released with all of the other families who were separated and reunified? Why are they one of less than 100 families that now sit in Dilley without any deadline or date upon which they will see their freedom? New families come to Dilley every single day. These families were never separated. They have interviews with an asylum officer. They are promptly released. And every day, these small circle of families, the other families come and go. They ask me, why are we here? When will this end? I have few answers. Behind closed doors, the mothers have other worries. One mother has a breast in her lump. She needs a biopsy. She worries she has cancer. Another discloses that her daughter has cancer. When her daughter was 6 years old, she was told she would die. She survived after 6 surgeries. This daughter, alive now, was within her mother's mind and heart every single second that they were separated. And she wondered how her daughter was, how her health was, if she was safe. These mothers beg for my help, and they ask that I deliver their pleas. They seek freedom for their children. Their children have stopped eating. They are sick. They live in fear every single day while they're in government custody that they will be separated again. and the trauma of their family separation defines every single second of their day while they remain detained. They ask for assurances that they will not be separated from their children yet again by this government who has left them in complete legal limbo. They know that no one can protect and love and provide safety to their children other than them. They ask above all for safety for their children and for themselves, safety from harm, from threats of death, from beating, from sexual assault, from forced servitude that they survived in the countries that they flee. They have found hope in the support of the Dili Pro Bono Project. They have access to lawyers every day who stand by their side, lawyers who fly to Dili from across the country to fight for them, to fight for their safety, their freedom, and their family unity. They know these lawyers and their many allies stand for rule of law, application of law that is just and fair. They give them crucial information that they were denied during their days or months of separation from their children. They hope and pray that these lawyers and their allies represent the United States, a place of welcome and humanity. But they question whether or not their experiences of coercion, detention, separation, and torture define this place where they seek refuge. This week, every single day, many of the mothers and children in the circle that gathers every night at 7 p.m. in Dili, Texas, have spent the days making bracelets out of strings that they have found in the facility. The bracelets are blue, a color that represents the flag, one color of the flag in Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras. These bracelets to them represent their fight for safety, for family, and for freedom. They wear these bracelets in unison as a sign of hope and unity. They ask me to wear one too. They ask that others join them in their fight and wear one in their dedication to these families' fight for freedom and safety. They state that they will cut these bracelets off once they leave this place, this jail in the middle of nowhere that has become their home. They will cut them off when every single parent who has been subjected to separation from their children in detention has secured their freedom and a fair day in court. Thank you.
Thanks, Shay. Taylor, again, legal coordinator at Annunciation House, why don't you talk a little bit about your role in this?
Yeah, good morning. My name is Taylor Levy. I'm the legal coordinator at Annunciation House. Annunciation House is a migrant house of hospitality, essentially a shelter that has been operational since 1978. And we receive families who are released on their own recognizance. Prior to the issue of family separation, we continue to receive those families as well, families who are released with GPS ankle monitors, who are asylum seekers. We've been receiving those families in particular since 2014. We have our internal legal program that has also been working with providing legal services to all the families who are released to us and families who show up at our house in other ways. We have been observing the issue of family separation that has been taking place in El Paso since the Trump administration came to power. It was something that we were seeing repeatedly that us and our other partners here on the ground in El Paso were speaking to the press about. We were visiting with clients about. One of the lead plaintiffs in the Miss L litigation is someone who I myself was visiting in detention for about 3 to 4 months before we ended up finding her counsel. She was separated from her son for close to 9 months altogether. And during that time, we worked with other parents who were separated. And every time we spoke out about it, the official answer from ICE was that this was not occurring, that family separation was not happening. However, in May, when the announcement was made, part of the announcement was stating that in El Paso had actually been ground zero for the pilot program in the El Paso sector to try family separation and try it out. So we were vindicated in the fact of obviously it was something that we were seeing. What ended up happening is after the presidential order and the injunction, El Paso and Annunciation House was picked as one of 4 sites in the country to receive the released families. Prior to that announcement, we received approximately 50 parents who were released to us on orders of supervision and released under cognizance without their children. And then after that, we got about 325 families released to us with their children. Many of those parents told us the same things that Shay and Katie were speaking about in terms of that they had signed forms, that they had signed forms that they did not understand and they did not know what they had said. They felt like they had to, and all of the same stories about the coercion. Since the deadline, we've only had 5 other families reunited and released. Apart from that, we are currently still working with 65 parents who remain detained in the El Paso area. we believe that the private bar and other nonprofits have another approximately 10 parents. So it's around 75 parents who remain detained in the El Paso area. Of the 65 we are working with using the attorney pro bono attorneys who are coming down from across the United States to help us to represent these families through the American Immigration Council, 43 of those parents have children who are still in OR custody. And so just as Shay was speaking about the sadness and the worry, they are terrified about how long are their children going to remain detained? How long are their children going to remain detained away from them? Many of them, by the time that we reached them, they had never spoken to their children, despite the deadline that there had to be a call established within those 10 days. The youngest child who we are working with is only 4 years old. We have several children who are 5 years old, 6 years old. We have several parents who are indigenous language speakers. In fact, it is a disproportionate number of the parents we are working with. And they have told us that they are worried about their children who do not speak Spanish, do not speak English, being in detention. One of the most egregious things that we saw was several parents have told us about being reunited on the deadline. They were reunited with their children on July 25th, and they were put onto a bus. They were reunited with their children for approximately 2 hours on that bus. The bus was running, it was air conditioned. They were, you know, celebrating. They were told by ICE that they were going to be taken to a shelter. They would be put on a plane and taken to a shelter and were going to be released to that shelter. They instead stayed on the bus, like I said, for several hours. They drove about 10 minutes away and then turned around and drove back to the El Paso Service Processing Center, where ICE agents boarded the bus and came on with forms that were pre-checked saying that they agreed to be deported with their children. And the ICE agents boarded this bus. This is a form that they had previously signed, not agreed, and they told them that they had to sign, and they yelled at them. And the parents have told us that everyone, there were multiple parents crying on that bus as they were listening to ICE and trying to sign. We have spoken to seven different parents who refused to sign despite multiple attempts by ICE saying that they had to sign. They refused to sign the form. One checked a different box, even though the form was pre-checked out, saying, no, I do not agree to be deported with my child. And the officer angrily pulled it away, crumpled it up, and handed him a new form and said, no, you were supposed to sign here. Eventually, those seven parents were taken off of the bus. They were taken inside. They were yelled at more by ICE. ICE told them, we're going to go and round up all of your sponsors and teach you a lesson. They told them that they were bad parents for abandoning their children. They brought them back outside, and they refused to let them even board the bus to say goodbye to their children. Instead, one of the children tried to get off the bus to say goodbye, and he was yelled at by ICE as well. And so that these seven parents, one mother and six fathers, were forced to wave goodbye to their children a second time as the bus drove away. They were then reshackled, re-put back in prison uniforms, and taken back to the various facilities. Apart from the bus people, who were reunited on the bus, we have several families, several parents who were told they were going to be reunited. They were given release paperwork. They still have copies of the release paperwork saying that they were going to be released on July 25th. They were instead brought to holding cells, put in civilian clothing, said they were going to be released, and never actually given back their child. For many of those parents, they were taken to a waiting room, a large room that was filled with children and teenagers and filled with parents. But it wasn't the right kids and the right parents, perhaps something along those lines. We still don't know all the details. Those children were then taken back from the waiting room. They were taken to Tornillo for a few days, and then they were flown back across the country to Miami and Houston and New York and Harlingen to their original placements. So during that week-long period between the 26th and the next week, it took us several days to be able to find the locations of any of those children because they had been officially discharged by OR, but they were not actually physically discharged and we couldn't re-find them. At this point, the same thing that's happening to what the parents are saying to Shay of why did this happen to me? Why have I not been reunified? Why have I not been released? We're getting the same questions of why have I not been reunified? Why have I not been released? We have parents who are begging for their children, begging to be reunified, even understanding that they might be taken to the horrors that are family detention, but they just want to see their child again. At this point, it's been 3.5 months. So that is what we're dealing with here in El Paso, and I will pass it back to Ben.
All right. Thank you all very much. I think it's probably just best to take some questions now. So, Wendy, if you want to tee that up.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch tone keypad. If you find your question has been addressed, You may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. And we'll take our first question from Tal Capone with CNN. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for holding the call. I have a couple questions. One is, what legal recourse might there be beyond just asking the IG and Civil Rights Office to look into it in terms of, you know, opening cases for these parents in some sort of court? Secondarily, I just wanted to follow up with Shay. You said a mother was told that a father in the detention center had hung himself. Do you guys have any corroboration for that, any further details that could be looked into regarding whether that actually occurred? Because we have heard of no suicides in the context of this in detention.
Okay, I can take just a quick answer to that first part, which is, you know, these declarations, similar kinds of declarations have been used and trying to coordinate, collaborate with the ACLU in their and others in their litigation efforts. Again, not just the ACLU, but other litigation that's ongoing. So I think that's part of the potential legal recourse. I think we are looking at other litigation options related to this, but felt very strongly that a complaint within the system itself, it's in DHS to do, you know, try to force them to engage in a little introspection is an important part of how this needs to play out. The agency has to look itself in the mirror, and we have to determine to what degree can it, effectively oversight behavior that happens within the agency. So this is an important piece of determining the reforms that are needed within the agency and the agency's ability to address these concerns internally, but it's not the only recourse that will be available. Shay, do you want to talk a little bit about the other case?
Sure. So I am aware of one story that did come out in the press regarding a father who took his own life after separation from his child. That is a story that broke in Texas back in June, I believe. In terms of my client who's reported this story, I have not been able to independently corroborate it, but I do believe with certainty that that is her understanding and what she was told by officials at the jail where she was detained.
Okay, so she was at a jail, because I know that the father killed himself at a jail. This where she was told this was not at one of the detention centers, is that correct?
Yes, it was in an ICE detention facility in Texas. And I'm happy, this is actually a story that was shared with me just last night, and I'm happy to try to get additional information if that would be helpful and to follow up after the call.
Yeah, it would be great if we could be in touch afterwards.
Sure.
Thank you.
Next question.
Yes, and once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone keypad. We will pause momentarily to allow any questions to queue. And once more, that is star and one on your touchtone keypad to ask a question.
All right. Well, if there are then no more questions.
We did actually just receive one.
Okay.
And we'll take our next question from Angela Kocherga with the Albuquerque Journal. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
I had to unmute myself. This is going through the two channels, these complaints. What kind of response or how quick has ICE indicated that they are going to start investigating? Or, I mean, how soon do you think you could hear back about these things, especially those parents who were on the bus and then locked up again?
Response times from these offices have been a problem. There's no question about that. I think this, although it's important to file these complaints in these offices, I think one of the systemic challenges that we've talked about here is in many instances, certainly the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, don't have the requisite authority. They don't have the kind of teeth that they need to really be significant agents of change within the agency, at least historically. So I think part of this is shining a light on what the agency will do with the mechanisms that it has supposedly stood up to be able to address these kinds of concerns. If their answer is, you know, nothing but silence, then I think that will be another. It'll be, you know, more reasons for deep concern about what's happening and the agency's ability to respond to it. So, you know, the Inspector General is also a role that, you know, can and should look into what's happening and act quickly and decisively to put protections and procedures in place, not only to address these instances of abuse, but to insulate against future instances of abuse. It certainly has the resources to be able to do that in a timely and effective way. Whether it will choose to do that or not, and whether these offices will, you know, will choose to respond in an aggressive and timely manner, is something that we all need to be watching.
This is Katie. Ben, I wonder if I could just add to that just a little bit. I did want to say that the two oversight agencies, CRCL and the OIG, have, you know, in the past couple of years, they have been fairly engaged with issues that we bring to their attention. And we are hopeful that they will open up investigations into this issue, particularly because it certainly does raise issues of illegal actions by government officials. So I will say that, you know, it looks very promising that they will open up investigations.
Thank you.
And we have no further questions at this time.
Excellent. All right. Well, then, thank you all very much. I think you all have information on where to go with any follow-up questions. George Tamaris and Tess Wiseman, Tessa, are available. And thank you all very much.